Welcome back to part two of my discussion with Harmeet Dhillon, Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice. Let me shift to election integrity. I mean, this is obviously front and center, as maybe there's a half a dozen things that are front and center. But what's going on with your office on things like to ensure election integrity? I mean, I think we can't have a country where we can't trust the elections. I mean, this is a worldwide problem, really. Now, I mean, Brazil is an example of where there's all kinds of issues, and you know, the trust, the restoration of trust, probably starts with the election system. What's going on with election integrity these days?
Okay, so big picture, let me talk about setting the table here. A lot of Americans don't want to hear this, but under our constitutional scheme, most of our laws involving the conduct of our elections, including federal elections, are set by state legislatures. That's in the Constitution. Okay, so not state secretaries of state or state Supreme Courts or state, you know, attorneys general. So that's our system of federalism. I like it. It has mixed results. In the state that you and I love, I used to live in for 25 years, California, very mixed bag, terrible laws and bad enforcement and just unclean voter rolls, et cetera. But there are a few federal voting rights laws, and I administer them at the Department of Justice. The Voting Rights Act, the Help America Vote Act, the National Voter Registration Act, and a law called UOCAVA, which involves military and overseas voters. We administer those laws. Sure. And so in those cases, we're entitled to demand data under the Civil Rights Act of 1960 on behalf of the Attorney General on data that states maintain with respect to their voter rolls. We're entitled to look at that. We're entitled to compare it to other states. And we made those demands under the Help America Vote Act and National Voter Registration Act over the last few months to several states. We had a shutdown for the last, you know, there were 6 weeks of a shutdown in the last couple of months. And so we've had that interrupt some of our work. But I filed 8 lawsuits around the country against states that have refused to turn over their voter rolls. I recently got a letter from 10 states saying, oh, we don't know what you're going to do with that stuff, Ms. Dhillon, and so we're not going to give it to you. Well, they don't really get to do that. The 1960 Civil Rights Act is actually very clear. The Attorney General doesn't have to show her homework as to what she's going to do with it, and I'm her designee, so I get to ask for that information, and they have to give it. Now, some of the like really silly defenses that states have given to giving this information, which includes like for me to compare one state with the next state to make sure that people aren't registered to vote in two different jurisdictions or they aren't dead or whatever, is Social Security number. Well, some of them have said, oh my goodness, you know, that Social Security information, that's private information. That's personal identifiable information. Mm-hmm. We can't give it to you. Well, who issues the Social Security numbers, Scott? The federal government issues the Social Security number. That's just plain silly. Secondly, what I found is Michigan and some of these other states that are refusing to give over their information, they're freely giving this information to liberal organizations, to non-government organizations for their purposes. So I don't really see the privacy issue there. Mm-hmm. So we're litigating these issues one by one in federal court.
Is there a potential to have legally potential to have a federal voter ID law?
That is a good question for the legislature. Call me an old-fashioned libertarian and privacy advocate. I am leery of federalizing just about anything. Very few exceptions to that is my gut. And under the last administration, Nancy Pelosi tried to push through what's called HR1, which would have dumbed down the entire country's voting standards to California's. Now, do you want that? I don't want that.
No.
I also don't want Big Brother. When I think about AI that we discussed earlier, I think about 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's a horror story. And that's my personal reaction.
Let me ask about the general concept of civil liberties in emergencies. And the idea, my idea, and I've said this, and I again, I have no legal education, but as a person who's sort of libertarianish, if you have a situation where an emergency can be declared to circumvent what are called guaranteed freedoms in the Constitution, then there's no such thing as a guaranteed freedom, because anyone can declare an emergency. We saw it during COVID. We saw lockdowns. We saw all kinds of things. You could say there's a climate emergency at some point. You could say a lot of things. Where am I going wrong here? Because what I think is you can, if it's a guaranteed freedom, I don't care what the emergency is.
Well, Scott, you're absolutely correct. And you and I both lived through these wars. You were an expert witness for me in cases involving challenging over 20 cases. In the cases that I filed against Governor Newsom, I also sued New Jersey, Virginia, Hawaii over their myriad and gross violations of our federal civil rights. Now, I hope I'm not going to bore your audience getting into the weeds too much here, but what has happened is the early rulings and most of the rulings to this date that courts entered relied on this emergency power theory that you just alluded to in your question under a case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. I think it's 1903 case involving a fine for not taking the smallpox vaccine. The fine was like $15 and you know Jacobson challenged it and the court said, oh, it's an emergency, so the government can do whatever it wants to you. Mm-hmm. Scary, scary stuff. But scarier is in the intervening 120 years, the United States Supreme Court has built up an entire extremely elaborate jurisprudence of tiered scrutiny. And this, you know, started out with, 1930s, 1940s. And some of these cases involve parental rights and some of these cases involve abortion and they involve Brown versus Board of Education. They involve all these interpretations of the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, importing concepts of the Bill of Rights into incorporating them into the states. And it says that there's rational basis review for certain rights. There's intermediate scrutiny for certain rights. And there's strict scrutiny for certain rights. And so if you're in the strict scrutiny category under a normal non-emergency scheme, you know, you're usually going to win if you're challenging the government. If you're in a rational basis review, the government's usually but not always going to win. Sometimes the government's actions are irrational. And then intermediate, it's kind of more complicated to prove. What the COVID courts did, and I will never forget the first case I argued when I was challenging the state of California arresting people for driving into a parking lot and in a church and opening their windows and hearing the pastor pray and preach a sermon. The court said, what do you mean strict scrutiny, Ms. Dillon? I think there's no scrutiny because it's an emergency. I mean, this was one of the most shocking moments. I'm sure if I ever write a memoir, it's going to be in my memoir, sitting in that chair in the Sea Ranch, California, and hearing a federal judge say that to me. I was literally shocked to my core. But you and I heard it from judge after judge after judge. And so the Supreme Court finally corrected that, but only in the context of religious freedom and First Amendment under the First Amendment, religious liberty, against Gavin Newsom three times. Gish versus Newsom, South Bay United versus Newsom, and Tandon versus Newsom, all three cases that I was involved in at some level or the other. And they left standing restrictions on stores being shut down. Like if you were a big box store, you could sell lawn furniture, but if you were a patio world, you couldn't sell lawn furniture. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to get married, you couldn't get married in a public ceremony. If you wanted to go visit your adult disabled child, you couldn't. If you wanted to travel from one island of Hawaii to the other, to your different properties, you couldn't. Those rulings are still good law in the United States. So I actually think the Supreme Court has some work to do. Mm-hmm. And God forbid that we ever have that situation where it has to be tested. I hope there are some less extreme situations than COVID where they can fix their errors, because errors they are. It is erroneous, in my opinion, to be relying on some 100-year-old outdated precedent when the intermediate numerous hundreds of decisions that the court has entered contradict that. And so that was a failure of courage, a failure of integrity by many courts, by almost every court in America. And it leaves all of us vulnerable to the next COVID. Some foreign power comes in and creates a virus, and we're all suddenly back in jail.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's shocking to me to think that a government could not only close the businesses, close the schools, mandate you're inside, all these things, but force you to take an injection of a drug. And this was all exposed by COVID, but of course it existed beforehand. I mean, I think most of us were not even thinking about these things when we were told that children had to have certain vaccines to go to school, for instance, which is these mandates of drugs to me. I wonder how, if there's any comment you can even give on what the future of drug or vaccines are drugs, mandates are, given that there's been a sort of an awakening of at least some of the public to the sensitivity toward being forced to inject a drug into you or your child.
Yeah, I can't really tell you where that's going to shake out, but I agree with your premise, which is that the Orwellian I would call it violence, the state's violence against the citizens, forcing these drugs to participate in society, get educated, eat at a restaurant in San Francisco. You had to show your vaccine papers.
Mm-hmm.
Cross county lines. It was illegal to cross county lines for a non-exempted purpose in California for years. It's insane. And that happened. And who benefited? When you ask the Latin cui bono, who benefited? Well, the pharma execs were buying multimillion dollar condos all over the country, and their glee for their sudden upside. This is a bipartisan issue. I think the extent to which lobbying and, big pharma and big education have outsized control over our elected officials, that is a problem. I don't know the solution to that, but mm-hmm. I do think that when you think about our individual rights and our individual liberties, I can't be forced to utter certain phrases by the government, but I can be forced to take a drug if I want to participate in society, be able to buy a car, get education, get a loan or whatever. This is insane, and it needs to be corrected.
Yeah. I think part of the problem isn't just the people in charge, though, making these laws. There's to me, a huge deficit in courage among regular people. And I can't help but think that. I know it sort of sounds like I'm blaming people who were fed propaganda or whatever, but at some point, you have to be a thinking individual. And I can't keep excusing people. This is just my own personal opinion for just constantly acquiescing to things like that.
I agree with you. But, I think, Scott, you and I may be on the margins on this issue. Way too many Americans give in to the peer pressure. I was listening to a podcast earlier today when someone was talking about the sort of the gang mentality. You're part of a club, and the club believes in 19 things that you believe in. And suddenly they're also believing that boys can become girls and that, injecting yourself every 3 months with a new version of a vaccine that isn't really a vaccine that causes heart issues and myocarditis in children is a good thing. I mean, in my coastal community where I still have a home in California, a second home, every couple of weeks, there's like someone puts out a notice. Hey, I guess you can get your vaccination, your latest vaccination down at the store. And you would never have the guts on that listserv to come out and say, well, that's silly. Like, why are you doing that? The COVID was a long time ago. Like, people have this sheep-like mentality.
Yes.
And in fact, you're some kind of sociopath putting, I'll never forget, people were like, how dare you come from San Francisco to Sonoma County? You're bringing vectors of disease into our rural community. Vectors of disease, by the zoning rules over there, everyone has like an acre of land and there's like running paths. There's the ocean right there. Vectors of disease. It was absolutely science-free, hysterical propaganda that persists in people's minds to this day. Particularly
yes.
Worked on older people, but also your average, highly educated, liberal white woman in the suburbs was equally susceptible to that.
Yeah.
So
unfortunately,
it does make you despair.
Younger people, too. I want to finish, if I can, a few minutes on just some personal thoughts. And, you mentioned you're an immigrant. You were born in India. You lived in London. Then you came to the U.S. as a legal immigrant family. And, you know, immigration is a huge fundamental part of the U.S. And I was also an immigrant family. I was born in the U.S., but my grandparents were not. They came, in my view, because they wanted to be Americans. That my grandmother, I have fond memories of her really saying, I don't want to have an accent from where I'm from. I want to speak English perfectly. Nowadays, we have people, immigrants who are not just illegal, but we have people who are even legal, but they sort of resent America. We see it in the political sphere. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how immigration has changed. Yes, it's a fundamental part of the success of America, but that was a different construct because immigration was for people who wanted to be American. And now we have all kinds of parts of our country where people don't speak English, and it's not to the level of the UK where there are these no-go zones or whatever. But what are your sort of thoughts, or if you can reflect a little bit on how immigration has totally changed now and where do we go from here? It's not just a legal issue, it's a cultural issue.
No, you're absolutely right. And so when I think about my parents, they aspired to come to the United States because they believed that the liberties of the United States and the Constitution were an aspiration to them. They wanted to raise their children in that freedom and that liberty. And they were the most patriotic of Americans. I remember that my mom was like a election monitor in rural North Carolina for the Republican Party when North Carolina wasn't a Republican state. But those were the values that they believed in family and in freedom. And they espoused those values. They supported those candidates. And they taught my brother and I at the dinner table about taxes, about contributing back to society, about the rule of law, about the First Amendment. These are very important concepts. And, you know, we were very, very much loving America and gave up our citizenship of a foreign country. I actually think that allowing dual citizenship is problematic in my personal opinion. And certainly for any elected official, for them to be dual citizens, I think really shouldn't be allowed. I think that's just insane. Secondly, you can't be a country if you don't have borders that you control and you enforce. And I look at my country where I was born in India. You can't go to India and hang out there for endlessly. They'll kick you out. Even if you're an American, you're not welcome to hang out there forever. They enforce their borders.
Right.
And so America has the right and actually the duty for the quality of life of American citizens to enforce its borders. And the recent trend that happened in the last administration of simply opening the borders had a political motivation to it, I believe. And you couple that with the election laws that I try to enforce in my power as the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, and you realize that our loosey-goosey laws have been engineered and designed in a way to actually fundamentally change America, because the people who want to change America couldn't do it with the Americans. The Americans love America the way it is. To change it fundamentally and alter it several standard deviations from what it is, to use scientific terms that you're familiar with, you had to literally import foreign people and concepts into the country to do that, people who hate America, which is ultimately nihilistic and destructive of our body politic. So I do think that we are facing this tipping point in some communities. And this concept that, you know, immigrants are the best of us or are naturally better or something is silly. It's fake. They're no better or no worse as such. But if they're not agreeing to sign up for the social contract that binds any society together, mm-hmm. shared values, shared concepts, shared agreement with norms of like the First Amendment, they're alien and they're ultimately hostile to the United States. And so I think that's really where I come down, is that, you know, president's married to an immigrant, you know, the vice president is married to a beautiful lady from an immigrant family. Many people who serve in this administration are immigrants, but all of them love America. That's what we have in common. And if you don't have that, you don't have a right to be here and stay here, in my opinion. And so mm-hmm. we're seeing some new laws, some old laws being brought back. The public charge law recently. The idea that if you're on welfare, you're not eligible for permanent settlement in this country. And that's a basic concept. If you're going to be a welfare queen or king, you don't have a right to be here in this country. You're not contributing. If you can't come in the front door and follow the laws.
You're saying as a non-citizen.
As a non-citizen. You can't come in and break our laws. I mean, you hear politicians every day say it in D.C. right here that, oh, well, the people are there. Yeah, sure, they don't have papers, but they're paying their taxes. They're following the law. No, they're not. They broke into this country. It's like right. A squatter living in your house. Oh, yeah, but maybe they're paying the electrical bill, but they don't own your property. They didn't get there legally, and they're actually occupying it to the exclusion of somebody else. So in the Civil Rights Division, one of our top priorities has been to enforce our laws that protect American workers from discrimination by cheapo employers who like to, you know, shave a few points and save a few bucks by paying foreign workers less than American workers, or even paying them the same or just preferring them because they can keep them under their thumb. That's illegal in America, and we're putting a stop to it in coordination with the Labor Department, the EEOC, and other aspects of the government working together with the White House. But look, in my opinion, as a woman who loves this country, the best country on earth, and I've traveled to dozens of countries around the world, and I'm an immigrant, is that you must subscribe to and share the fundamental American values that bind us all. And if you don't, there are plenty of other countries. You can go live in Europe. You can go live under the thumb of the, you know, jackbooted police who arrest people for tweets. Or you can live somewhere else where you think it's utopian, or New Zealand, which has got beautiful views and kind of crazy laws when it comes to some of these liberty issues. So that's my view. To be an American truly, you must embrace all of our American laws and our values, our concept of Thanksgiving, our concept of shared social principles of mutual respect and free speech and equal protection, and not judging people according to how they were born or what color they were born, but, you know, what their potential is and their ability is. And I think that these are some of the things that I think are really critical. If we don't enforce those laws and those concepts socially and legally, we are doomed as a country.
Right. That's very well said. And there is an American culture. This is what's interesting, is somehow we're viewed as this multicultural place with immigrants from everywhere. But the reality is there is a very distinct American culture. And in my view, that's why people want to come here. And so to pretend like somehow you should be welcoming everybody, even if they despise the country or resent the country, it's just a huge misunderstanding of what it is to be an American. So I, in the interest of not taking up too much of your time, I have so many other questions, but I'm going to have to ask you if we can come back at some point, because I have so many questions, including these legal questions that are related to immigration and to really who violated the law here beyond the person who actually came across. Because mm-hmm. to me, if there's an unknowing disregard of immigration law by officials in the United States government, I would think that would be a crime. We don't have time to go into that, and I don't want to take too much of your time, but as a naive person, I think, okay, but if it was intentionally disregarded, that's breaking the law, I would think.
If a government official colludes with a non-governmental organization, even a church, for example, a charity, to bring people wholesale into this country illegally, or to look the other way when children are trafficked into this country that end up being trafficked for either adoption or sexual purposes illegally. These are conspiracy charges that could be brought. But I would be happy to continue this conversation, Scott, another time. It was wonderful to talk
great.
To you.
Great talking to you, Harmeet. Thank you again for all the time, and keep up the great work.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Harmeet Dhillon, follow her work as Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division in the Trump administration. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now, and I'll see you next time.